tell you, I sure enjoyed sitting on this bench, but I think I could have preached better if y'all had a recliner for me. That's just a joke. Please forgive that. Thank you so much for coming tonight, and appreciate your presence and the singing of these songs and prayers and things we're doing. I tell you, you're helping me. I'm not going to go away from here the way I came. And that's what I love about meetings. They always change me and affect me. And so getting to meet God's people all over the place and getting to sing these songs. When I was in school, played some sports, and I can remember I tell folks on the football field many times we'd be taking a terrible beating, and it looked like that we just couldn't do anything to change the momentum, and we'd hear the crowd chanting in the stands, and something would be echoing over the field, and the chants and the voices of those people chanting and singing something would get in the hearts and the minds of the players on the field, and the ball game would go in a different direction. And that's what singing does to me. It's teaching me and cheering me on to keep thinking about who I am and where I'm going, what life's about. So thank you so much for what you've done tonight, but you're coming and you're singing those songs together tonight. I want you to open your Bible up tonight. I'm going to switch some gears. The sixth chapter goes on to really talk more about riches, and we looked pretty much in great detail at that yesterday. And so that chapter really just kind of shows you the picture of an old boy who reminded me one time. I read about a man who said he thought he would climb the ladder of success and climb to the ladder of riches and glory of money. And said he said he got to the top, and he said, I didn't realize when I got up there was nothing there. He said, I finally realized I'd been climbing the wrong ladder all my life. And so if you're climbing the ladder to try to find money and fame and happiness with material things, you're going to find out you're climbing the wrong ladder. You won't find it up there. You'll get up there and find out there's nobody up there and there's no happiness up there either. And that's not to say that it's wrong, that money is wrong. It's not wrong to say that getting rich is wrong. There's nothing wrong with that. But to make that what life is about is a mistake. So don't think I'm saying it's wrong to do well and to be successful. I think that people ought to work hard and do what they do as best that's in them, and whatever reward is, they ought to thank God and enjoy it. So it's not wrong to be rich. Abraham was the richest man in the East, I believe the Bible says. That's a direction and not a city. And so you think about what good that there is in that, but not to think that that's what life's about. But now I want you to look in the seventh chapter tonight, and I want you to think about, here's the writer who's going to talk to us about better things and how to make better decisions, and really just to how to kind of, do you notice how sometimes life seems to kind of get out of balance, and you kind of feel like, well, I don't really know what's the best thing to do sometime, and you try to weigh. In the book of Proverbs, the word ponder, by the way, if you look that word up, it means to get life into balance. And so you sometimes, if you're not careful, life kind of gets out of kilter, and you kind of end up leaning to one side and running off the road. And so you've got to kind of keep this thing like riding a bicycle. You got to keep pedaling, and you got to keep turning into the way you're about to fall, and just keep balance so you can get through life. And so really, some of these principles are just going to show us the significance and the value of trying to balance life. And he begins by saying to us in verse 1 of the 7th chapter, a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Now think about the first of all when he says here that a good name is better than precious ointment. When you think about a good name, you're talking about somebody's reputation. And when you think about precious ointment and perfumes, you remember when the alabaster box was broken for Jesus and she brought this valuable perfume to anoint Jesus, and Jesus said that would be remembered for a long time. Judas wanted to know, the others wanted to know why such a waste was made when it could have been sold and given. And Jesus said, don't you bother her. And so this woman had come with this precious ointment to put on the body of Jesus. And you know, in those days, it's like today. If you have some precious ointment, some precious perfume, my wife, I always kind of wondered about my wife when I found out she was buying perfume that was called Ambush and Poison. I thought, well, what in the world, you know? But you think about what perfume does, and really what perfume did when somebody died in those days. When Jesus was living, of course, there wasn't the kind of process we go through today, and so a body would begin to smell, and so people would go and put different perfumes on the body so that the body wouldn't smell bad. Well, today, we put it on the body before we get to the grave, you see. And we try to cover up the body smells, the odors of a body. And, you know, it's one thing to think about the fact that somebody might think, well, you know, I would like not, I don't want to be offensive to people, I don't want to smell bad. But I'm going to tell you, it's more important because you can put perfume on and smell good outside, but you can be a dead corpse inside. And so what really significant is, what am I inside? Who am I? What is my name? When people say my name, what comes to their mind? When you say Jesus Christ, what comes to your mind? So you see, a name means something. Who you are. And if you think about it in your life when you're living, what you want to do is you want to live in such a way so that your reputation will precede you in a good way, not in a bad way. And so the writer says it's just more significant and better for somebody to work hard and diligent to make sure that your name means something rather than just to try to cover up the outward appearance of what might else be. And then he says to us, not only that, but he says, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Now think about that. We celebrate birthdays. We don't celebrate death days. But when you think about what a birthday is the beginning. It's where you start. It's kind of like you think about a life being kind of like a vacation. And when you take a vacation on the first day, was that the greatest day, your vacation? You know, as you go along in this thing and as you venture through it and you finally get somewhere and go somewhere and accomplish things and you come to the conclusion of it, you find out really what the good of it was. You see, at the beginning, you don't know. I don't know what I'm going to go through yet before I get to the grave. I'm not there yet. I don't know what I'm going to experience. What I don't know what's on the next curve or the next turn in my life. But I tell you one thing, I want to make sure when I get to the end of it that I have ended the way I wanted to when I started beginning, when I began the race, you see. And so here's a picture of thinking about the fact that the day of a death of a person is really much, much better than the day of a birth, because a lot of people start well, but not everybody finishes well. And so that might sound strange to us. Think that you mean that thinking about the day of death, that's a great thing? Yes, that's a great thing. The day of one's death is a great thing, a great day. And then he says in verse 2, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all men. And notice the living will lay it to his heart. And so he says, now let me tell you something else that's important. When you think about life, it's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. What if I were to tell you that tomorrow night that some brethren are going to get together and going to have a little party, eat some pizza and sing some songs and have a good time, but somebody else that I know has died and we're going to go to the funeral home and weep with the folks that have lost a loved one. And where do you want to go? Well, naturally, people think, well, going to a party, that's a lot of fun. That's where we would rather go. But you know what? The house of feast, the house of mourning, to go to the grave and to look at a coffin, and I know sometimes parents sometimes try to shelter their children from that. I don't want to take my children and see somebody that is dead. Let me tell you, don't shelter anything. Don't run away from life and don't run away from the reality of life, and let young people learn that everybody who comes in the world is going to die. And so what we need to see here is a picture of going to the house of mourning. Now, why is that so vital? We're going to see in a moment this sorrow and these tears are important to us. And so you go there and you look at somebody who has lived and died. And I'm still struggling with the boy I mentioned who died just a week and a half ago. And to think that I was his friend and close to him and trying to help him, 26 years old. I just can't get over the fact that he pulled the trigger. It's hard for me to get past that, you know. He's not here anymore. I can't do anything for him. I wish I had done more while he was living. But you see, his life and his death makes me do something. It makes me look at every person that I see now that I don't know what's in their mind, and I'm going to smile at you. I'm going to hug you, and I might kiss you on the head even, I don't know. But I'm going to say something kind to you and something to encourage you, because I don't know what's in your mind. I don't know what you're going through. You may have been beat up in some way. You may be at the end of the road. I didn't know he was at the end of the road. But to think of the fact that if we can see that going to the house of the mourning, going to a funeral home and looking there and thinking about life, the living will lay that to his heart. You're not going to learn much, and much will remain in your mind at a party. But when you go to a funeral, it will remain in your mind. It'll make you think about you're going to step over the threshold one day. And so go there and think about that. And notice he carries these thoughts a little further. The day of death, the graveyard, the funeral home. And then notice in the next verse, what goes on there, of course, is sorrow is better than laughter, for the sadness of countenance, the heart is made better. Now, have you ever thought about the fact, I tell people all the time, you know, some of my greatest teachers in life have been my tears. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes I've learned more about life shedding tears about something than I ever did laughing about something. There's been more impression made on my life and my thinking in the days of adversity, in the days of trouble and problems, and when somebody's suffering, when somebody's struggling, and I'm up in the middle of the night praying and thinking about something, Those tears have been my greatest teachers. And so don't think, oh, it's that person's having such a bad time. They're crying and suffering. Let me tell you, tears are a great, adversity is a great time in life. It's a great time to develop. It's the fires of life, the James says, are what try our faith and test us and make us become stronger and cause us to want to pray for wisdom and know how to live. And so if we can see here, good people, that tears and mourning, don't always try to laugh life off. We've got, matter of fact, with death, we've got to where we want to make death a celebration. It's a time of sorrow. It's a time of parting. Now, we know the saint, there's no reason to sorrow for him because he's gone to a good place, but we're saying goodbye for now, you see. And we're going to see them again, we know. But it's a time when we think about the parting of somebody we love and saying farewell to them. That's not, I don't care if somebody just comes to see me for a week or so and then they go away. I'll always feel sad when they go away. And so then here's the next picture he paints for us. He says in verse 4, the heart of the wise is in the house of the mourning, but the heart of the fool is in the house of mirth. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. Now notice, here's again the picture of a rebuke, a corrective statement, criticism being given to you. Sometimes you have to say things to people, and they're hard things, and they don't want to hear them. For example, if I were to say to you, look, you're going to get... I'm trying to think of some kind of shot you would take. If you don't take the shot, you're going to get some kind of a polio or something. And so you got to take this shot, or you're going to get this. And so it might seem bad, it might seem hard, it might seem like something you don't want. But what about the consequences? Now, what if somebody just sings a song to you? Oh, la 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 la, you're okay. Don't you go on. Don't worry about that. And just go on. Well, the song of a fool. You see, it sounds good. You like to hear it. You don't want to hear somebody tell you something you don't want to hear, something that bothers you, something that gives you trouble. But when you think about the fact of the matter is that you need to hear the sound of somebody saying you need a good shot in the arm for something you're doing that will prevent some other disaster in your life. And so he says to us in verse 6, for as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of fools. This also is vanity. Now think about the... If you've ever built a fire and you've ever gathered briars and thorns and you put those briars and thorns under a pot to cook, they'll always pop and crack and spark and make a lot of noise. But you can't cook your dinner on briars because they don't burn long. You got to have some firewood under there to have a fire. And so here's these people just saying good things. Oh, they make a loud noise and say a lot of things that don't make a lot of sense to you just to make you feel good. But that don't last, you see. It takes something more in life than just to hear somebody give you some song of fools and give you some song of praise when really what you need is to hear something that is straight and strong. And then the writer in verse 7 says, surely oppression maketh a wise man mad, and a gift destroyeth the heart. Now here's the picture of some of the things in life that we struggle with. When we look at oppression, and we see, as I've already mentioned to you, all the things, I can't imagine. I see just a little fraction of the suffering in my lifetime in the world, in the places where I've been. But what does God see? Think about the oppression that God has seen throughout human history, and what he sees not all around the world. We're not seeing any much oppression here tonight. But think about God is seeing all the oppression in the world. And when you think about that, sometimes it causes some people, the fellow in Acts, Asaph in the 73rd Psalm, he got discouraged and he got weak in his faith because he saw the righteous people suffering and the wicked people seemed like they got away scot-free. And it almost caused him, he said he felt like he was about to slip and lose his way. And so here's a picture of what oppression does to people. It causes them to just kind of lose your way if you're not careful. But notice the other side of that is, and a gift distorts the heart. You know, people bribe and give people things. And so here's where you might see justice. And sometimes somebody can come along and justice can be perverted because somebody gives a gift. And so those things cause us trouble in our life. They cause us to struggle. But he says, better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof. And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Now notice, here's a picture of when you begin in something, you see it, and you don't know how it's going to go, you don't know how it's going to turn out. So what you should do when there's some trouble, some problem in life, is to pray to have the wisdom to know how to deal with it, and to be patient, and let it ride through. Sometimes we want to solve things right now, we get in a hurry, we get hasty, And we make a mess out of things because we want to get control. Why do people lose their cool and have bad tempers? I've always said there. You think about people. There are two ways people deal with things that bother them. They can't control. It's the same way people sneeze. Have you ever noticed that? When some people sneeze, they'll try to hold it in. They'll blow their eyeballs out of their head, and they hold all that inside of them, and it just keeps building up inside. And other people, what they do is they sneeze all over everybody and make a mess everywhere. Well, I'm going to tell you what you need to learn. You need to learn that when things get out of control, the reason you lose your cool is you want control. That's what you want. You want to take control of this, and you're not going to let God control it. You're going to control it. And so he says, what you need to learn in life is when you're going through problems and trials, remember it's better for a person. If you think about when a person goes into something, the end is better. And so what you do is you be patient and you don't be proud, become arrogant about things. I've told a story about a fellow in Madison years ago. He and I were digging a ditch line for an old boy. His water line went across a creek bed and the ground had gotten cold and frozen. So he and I went over to dig that up. And so we were digging in that ditch line. And my old buddy, I knew he had a short fuse, if you know what I'm saying. And I knew that I'd always kind of be careful around him because he had to walk on eggshells. And so we were digging on each side of the ditch there in that slick creek bottom. And I went down one time to get a load of mud, and he was on the other side, and he went at the same time. And when I reared up, I bumped him on that creek bed. And when I did, he slipped, and he had a full beard. He went down and drove his face right in the mud hole. Well, he got up, and he had mud caked all over his face. And I thought, oh, man, I'm in trouble now. He had a shovel in his hand, you know. So I said, oh, buddy, I'm shy. I said, I don't know what to say. I said, I didn't mean. I said, I don't know. He's Sandusky, would you shut up? I said, well, I'm so sorry. He said, shut up. He said, don't you know when people work together, they're going to bump into each other? I thought, what a great thing to know. You know? I mean, you know, rather than blowing up, just realize we're going to bump into each other every once in a while. So I appreciate him telling me that, you know. I was glad to learn that. But now notice, in the next verse he says, be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of fools. Now think about that. We're telling a lot about ourselves when we lose our cool. When you just have to draw your sword and start wheeling on somebody, you're telling everybody something about who you are, what your name is, what your reputation is, you see. So you need to be careful when you get excited and want to lose your cool that you're telling everybody who you are. Don't do that. Don't be that kind of a person. Say not thou, what is the cause that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this. You think about today, what people do oftentimes is we'll talk about the good old days. You know, when I started driving the car, gas was 29 cents a gallon, you know. And I bought her a 1964 Chevy. It was two years old for $1,000, and it was in perfect mint condition, convertible car. I mean, it was something. And lived back in those days. Of course, in those days, we didn't have any air conditioning in our house. You'd sleep out on the porch sometime when it get hot, you know. And so there were a lot of mosquitoes and other things, you know, and all the problems that we had that went along with living back in those days. But, you know, we look back and we see a couple of those good old things, and we think, oh, that's the good one. Let me tell you, today is the best day. Make today the best day. And don't keep thinking, well, the good old days are back there. Let me tell you, live in such a way that you make good out of today. And don't say, oh, I wish I was back old. I heard about an old boy one time said, I wish I had lived in the 1800s. And a friend of his who'd known him all his life said, you wish you'd been born in 1800s? I said, yeah. He said, well, I thought when you were 10 years old, you had a cyst on your lung and it collapsed your lung. And they had to go in and remove that cyst. He said, well, that's the truth. He said, oh, boy, you'd only have been 10 years old if you lived back in those days. You see, we've got to think about the fact, look at all the blessings. Look at all the good. Look what's going on today. There's a lot of good in the world today. And so let's don't look back at the past and long for the past. Let's make something of today. We're not very wise to long for the past. And then he says to us in verse 11, wisdom is good as an inheritance, and by it there is profit to them that see the sun. And I'm not sure whether this is wisdom is good as an inheritance, or showing, comparing these two. Like, for example, if your parents give you an inheritance, you've got something rich and something blessing. That would be a blessing to get money from your parents. But what if your parents were to leave you for an inheritance? What if they were to pass wisdom down to you? and give you the ability to see life and understand what life is about and to be able to figure out how to solve problems in life. Think about which one of those would be the best blessing. Now, both of them together would be wonderful. Wisdom with inheritance would be a rich blessing. But you see, whether he's comparing them or putting them side by side, I'm not sure what the writer's trying to say. But in verse 12, he says, wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. And again, this could be a comparison or putting them side by side each other. They both have a way of defending you when you get into trouble and you have to go to court. Well, money's going to help you. But how much more will wisdom help you, see? And so he said, by the excellent of knowledge is that wisdom giveth life to them that have it. So think about this. Money can buy you a lot of things. But let me tell you, money can't buy you life. Money can't teach you how to live and how to enjoy life and how to enjoy and live in such a way that your life might even be extended by knowing how to live. And so if somebody says, here's a bar of gold or here's a book of wisdom, now which one you want? You want the bar of gold or the book of wisdom? Well, most of us would run and grab the bar of gold. So that's worth $10,000. I'll take that. But you see, here's a book that can tell you how to live and how to do well. When I was a kid, they always had a joke, say, would you rather have money or sense, you know? And they didn't mean nickels and dimes. They meant to have good sense. Well, if you've got good sense, you're going to do okay. You're probably going to get you a bar of gold if you keep at it. And so here's a picture of people looking at the value of wisdom and seeing what it can do and how it can affect your life and how it can give life to you. Verse 13 says, now listen to this. Consider the work of God. And look, we're talking about the sovereignty of God now. Consider the sovereignty of God, the work of God, for who can make that straight which he hath made crooked. Now think about that. If God puts a curve in the road, you think you're going to come along and straighten the curve out? You better turn your wheel, old buddy, and go around the curve. What you better do, you better realize if God made the road that way, you better follow the road that God made and stay on the road that he wants you to follow. And so if God has bent the road or put a crook in something, you go that way. He says, in the day of prosperity, be joyful. Now notice, when everything's going well for you, don't be afraid and ashamed. If you live in a nice, fine house, and you eat steak dinners, and you drive a fancy automobile, don't be ashamed of that. In the day of prosperity, rejoice. God didn't want you to say, you poor thing, you better sell all that and get out on the street with a cup and sell pencils and try to survive on nothing. God didn't want you to do that. In the day of prosperity, rejoice. But now notice on the other side of the fence, and we might think, well, this doesn't sound good to me. But on the other side of the fence, he says, in the day of adversity, consider. Now consider what? That God hath set the one over against the other to the end that man should not find nothing after him. And so you see, God, what God does is he mixes these things into life, you see. He gives you days of prosperity, and then you're going to see there are going to be days where you're going to have adverse things come, and God lets you face those. And in his providence, he knows those things are going to be good. Romans 8 chapter tells us that all things work together for good to them who love God. Those who are called according to his purpose. It all works out. I can't sometimes see that. I see something going on, I think this is bad, and I can't see any way in the world it's going to work out for good. And after a while, I find out that's exactly what needed to happen. I've told about, for years, I lived in Madison. There were some people there who they were a human chigger to me. Can I say it that way? They just got under my skin, and I couldn't figure out what to do. It was my ignorance and other things that bothered them. My spot of my grease just bothered them real bad, you know, rubbed all over their whole plate when I said something. And so I couldn't find what in the world. And so I just prayed and prayed and worked and kept behaving myself. And I think, what in the world is going to happen to make this thing turn around here, you know? And so I just kept praying. About 15 years it went on. And then all of a sudden what happened? I shouldn't tell this. It may get back home. But their daughter married a preacher. And so they started saying, you wouldn't believe what people say to preachers. I said, oh, really? You know, but you see, God can work things out. God can work things out. That's what can happen. And so notice, when you go on, the writer says to us in verse 15, he said, all things I have seen in the days of my vanity, there is a just man that perisheth in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man that prolongeth his days in his wickedness. And notice, you're going to see that in life. You're going to wonder, why does some good, godly, wholesome, a man who is a great leader and a great Bible student and a great influence, why does he die And some old wino sits out on the side of the highway, sits out there for years, and nothing seems to affect him. Why is that? And so the writer says, you see, somebody's happened in the world, and you just can't seem to understand what in the world, why are things that way? And then he says, be not righteous over much, neither make thyself over wise. Why shouldest thou destroy thyself? Now notice, we find in the Bible where there's warnings in Isaiah, the book of Isaiah, about somebody who has this holier-than-thou attitude, and somebody like the Pharisees is overmuch righteous. There are some people who think they don't ever do anything wrong. Do you know any of them? I told about a man one time. I sent a young boy to preach in a congregation, and this young boy went over and started preaching. He was there about 2 years, and this old man called me. He said, "Preacher, did you send this young boy over to preach for us?" I said, "Yes, sir, I sure did." He said, "Well, I wish you had sent him. He's the biggest ignoramus in the world. He doesn't know a thing in the world about the Bible." I said, "Well, brother, just hang on. Let me tell you something." He said, "What's that?" I said, "You just wait about 2 years, and that old ignoramus will study his Bible. In about 2 years, he'll know what you know. He'll be a know-it-all, and you'll get along just fine." But you see, we need to realize in the world, there are people who they think they know it all. You know what I'm saying? Some people think they know it all. They think they're just spiritual in every way, and they just don't ever do a thing wrong. They never see where they leave so much undone, they ought to be lost for what they left undone, let alone what they don't do. And so here's a picture of being careful that you not become overmuch righteous and look down your nose, thereabouts, and think that you've got all together and you can see all the specks in everybody else's eye, but you can't realize while you're picking at their speck, you got a beam sticking out of your own head. And so maybe we ought to just clean off our own ports a little better and not think that we're so great all of a sudden, you know. We know we're all in the same boat. We've all got problems. Why don't we just own up to it and admit it? Why don't we want to act like we just never have done anything wrong? I don't want people to think that about me. I'm struggling all the time to do right. And so here and then the writer says, so don't be overmuch righteous. And then he says, don't be overmuch wise. Now you know some people too who know everything, don't they? Some people just think they know everything. You can't tell them a thing in the world. They just think they're the smartest person that ever hit the town, and they can't learn anything. And so he says, what you do, if you're overmuch righteous or overmuch wise, what you do is you destroy yourself before your time. You're going to destroy your influence. People are not going to listen to you. They're not going to pay attention to you. So don't think that of yourself. If you think you're sitting up high above everybody else and looking way down everybody, and I tell you, you will be super critical like the Pharisees were. You'll find specks in there. Even Jesus, if you're a Pharisee, you'll see the flaws in the Lord, and you won't realize you're as blind as you can be. And so don't be like that. The writer says in the next verse, be not overmuch wicked, neither be thou foolish. Why shouldest thou die before thy time? Notice, here's a picture of somebody who looks at somebody who's a Bible, people call them Bible thumpers, you know. Somebody who just, they think they've got it all together, and they just go around looking at everybody. And so what this person does, he sees that Bible thumper. He said, I don't want anything. I'm going to just go the other way. And I'm just going to be as wicked as I can be. Some people are just driven to that. They're driven to be wicked because they hate so much somebody's trying to do right. And you need to realize if you're trying to do right, people, they hated Jesus without cause, they'll hate you without cause. But you need to realize, don't let somebody who wants to be overmuch righteous, no much wise, don't let them turn you. Well, I'm just sick of it. I'm going to give up and get out of it. I'm not going to have anything to do with it. No. That will destroy you before your time, you see. And so don't have that kind of spirit about life and what you're doing. And so he's showing us, let's have some balance in what we're doing. Let's be careful about what we're doing, don't you see? Verse 18 says, it is good that thou shouldest take hold of this. Yea, also from this withdraw not thy hand, for he that feareth God shall come forth of them all. Notice, how does a person become victorious over everything? Let me tell you how you do it. You fear God. You put your faith in God and you trust God and you rely upon God. And when you've got some big problem you can't handle, you just give it over to God. So there you go. I'm not going to worry about that. I'm going to go to bed and go to sleep now, Lord. I'm going to let you take care of it. And if you just put things in the Lord's hand and trust Him, let me tell you, you will find out what this says. You'll come through. That won't be when you want it. It won't be the day you want it. And I've seen a lot of things, like I've said, I've prayed for things a long time. And sometimes I thought, well, maybe I ought to give up on this. But I'm glad I didn't. I just kept praying about things and knowing that God would take care of the problem. And that's what He's done over and over. I've seen it 1,000 times in my life, and I'm sure you have too. And so the writer says, beyond that, wisdom strengtheneth the wise more than 10 mighty men which are in a city. Notice here's the value and the power of a person who has wisdom. A person who has wisdom is going to be a very strong person. Somebody can stand up in the face, and it doesn't matter what other people think, what other people say. I'm not going to cower in. I'm not going to be a follower of other people. Wisdom will give you the strength to stand up. I love that Proverb 28, verse 1. It says, a wicked man fleeth when no one pursueth, but the righteous are bold as a lion. You think about what it takes to have the courage and not be afraid, not be intimidated. I debated a fellow in Cincinnati years ago, and he had several degrees, and he could speak several languages. And so he asked me about writing out the proposition. He said, where'd you go to school? I said, I went to DuPont Manual, but I didn't legally graduate. He said, DuPont Manual? I said, it's a high school. I said, I don't legally have a high school education. He said, what? He said, you sure you want debate? I said, yes, sir. We want people to hear about this. And I said, why don't you? You're so educated. You just write the propositions up, and I'll look at them if I agree with him. And I said, you're older than me. You get up and talk. When you get through talking, if I agree with you, I'll just get up and say amen and sit down and let you go and talk again. But if I think you're not following the Bible, I'll just show you. And then you get up and answer me. He said, I never heard such a debate. I said, well, let's let the Bible be our proposition. He said, I don't never heard anybody do that. I said, why don't we try it? He said, okay, we'll do it. So we said, we're going to let the Bible be our proposition. And so we got, well, you know, he was in hot water as soon as he started. Because he started wanting to tell all about these things that the church he was going, all these things they were doing, and he couldn't find them anywhere in the Bible. And I kept saying, well, you're doing a lot of talking, but you haven't shown the verse yet. And I said, I'm still looking. I said, now, I'm not educated, and I'm sorry I'm so dumb I can't see it, but maybe you're saying I just can't see it. But you see, I wasn't intimidated because I knew he can't change this. You don't have to be afraid of anybody. I don't care how highly skilled and trained they are. Don't you be afraid of anybody. You be as bold as a lion. And that will intimidate people who try to pull the wool over on you. They'll finally feel like a sheep and they'll run away. That's what they'll do. And so here's a picture of not letting this world overwhelm us, becoming afraid and fearful. We put our fear in God, and our strength is in the wisdom that God has given to us. And then notice in verse 21 he says, also take no heed to all words that are spoken, lest thou hearest thy servant curse thee. For oft times also thine own heart knoweth that thou thyself likewise hath cursed thee. Have you ever overheard somebody saying something bad about you? I've heard a lot of people say bad things about me. And you know, when I hear some of that, I kind of think, well, I kind of wish I had. And I always tell preachers when we have a meeting. One time we had a fellow held a meeting. He was doing a great job, David Tomley. And one of the men came back and said, you listen to this old boy preach? I said, yes, sir, I'm listening. He said, you learn anything? I said, every time he opens his mouth, I'm learning something. He said, good, because he knows how to preach. Well, I want to take my sword out and whittle on that boy a little bit, but I didn't. I didn't say a thing to him, you see. I just realized, you know, when I think about what I'm doing in life and where I'm going, I've said things about other people. And so I'm not going to be too hard on somebody who says something bad about me, because I know I've talked bad about other people. And so I hope nobody's overheard all the bad things I've said. I've said some bad things I shouldn't have said. And so when you hear somebody say something bad about you, say, well, I better look in the mirror because I've done the same thing. And so I need to do better. So it just makes me want to quit doing what I'm doing, you see. So don't be so hard on people when you find out somebody said something bad about you. Then verse 23 says, all this have I proved by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. Notice he's talked about the value of wisdom, the good that it can do. But he says, now let me tell you something about wisdom. Wisdom will not give you all the answers to life's problems. You're going to run up against something in life. You're going to say, I don't know what to do about this. I'm kind of in the dark about how I should respond to this and what I should do. And so the best thing to do is just put your hand over your mouth and go back home. Because sometimes you don't know what to do. So wisdom's not always going to be the answer that you're looking for, you see. It's of great value, but even wisdom itself is limited. You're not always going to find what you're looking for. Then verse 25 says, I apply my heart to know and to search and to seek out wisdom and the reason of things, to know the wickedness of folly, even the foolishness of madness. I found more bitter than death a woman whose heart was snares and nets, and her hands were bands. Whosoever pleaseth God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. Now, here's a picture now, and this is going to seem like Solomon's kind of down on women when you think about it.
But it's just a picture of realizing in the world there are going to be people. And you know in the Proverbs, if you notice how sometimes there are statements said about women kind of in a negative way about a dripping faucet and things like that go up on the rooftop or out in the wilderness somewhere away from a woman who nags all the time. You know, the reason the Bible shows that is the power and the influence of a woman that does right is so powerful that when she turns that around and doesn't do it right, she is so destructive. And so here's a picture now of Solomon telling us when he's searching to find out all these things, know everything about wickedness and madness, he begins to think about something that is really bitter in life, more bitter than death. That's a woman. Notice this woman, when you look at her, her heart is snares and nets. You know what those are? Those are tools of hunters. Snares and nets are what people use when they're hunters. Here's a woman, she's hunting. And she's got her snares and her nets set out there, you see. And notice, when you look at her hands are banned. Her hands are chains. Now, what are chains? Chains are what you put somebody in prison with. What you chain somebody up with. You put somebody under, you have power over somebody, you can chain them up. So here's a woman who wants to capture somebody and chain him up and get control of him. And so she's out here going along, and Solomon sees this woman and says, this is more bitter than death. And so he says, let me tell you, the old boy that gets free from her is the old boy that pleases God. So how do you save yourself being captured by somebody that's not really doesn't love you, doesn't love God? They're just trying to catch somebody and put them in prison. What you do is you please God. And when you please God, you learn what God tells you what to look for. And you see in the book of Proverbs the value of a virtuous woman who is prized far above rubies. You know, a valuable woman is a valuable thing. And women that are, as the proverb writer tells us, that woman is a great treasure to everybody, even the Lord. And so that's what you're looking for. You're looking for a woman who wants to please God, who wants to go to heaven. And when she wants to go to heaven, you want to go to heaven, you two get locked on the same track, the old devil better get out of the way, buddy, because you're coming down the highway. And so the writer goes on to say, after making that statement, and we could say have the closing prayer and stop right there, but I want you to look a little further when he says, behold, this have I found, saith the preacher, counting one by one to find out the account, which yet my soul seeketh, but I find not. One man among a thousand have I found, but a woman among all those have I not found. Now somebody might say, well, that sounds like Solomon's talking awful hard about women. Well, will you tell me how hard is he on men? I mean, we only got one man in a thousand. And I think what we need to see in this is what was Solomon's problem to start with. Solomon had tried to make, how many women did he have? He had 700 wives and 300. He had 1,000 women. And what Solomon did was Solomon kept thinking, and you can see this, it seems to me, the Song of Solomon, the way I look at it anyway, that Solomon was looking for women, thinking that a woman was what would make life have meaning and purpose. He thought, if I just get the right woman, then I'll be happy and that will give my life meaning and purpose. And so women are what life's about. And when he went around trying to find a woman that would give all of life meaning, he couldn't find a one. And he found one man he thought had some sense and made some sense about life. But when he tried to make women what life's about, he couldn't find that. And so when you think of, some people think that God, their God is their family. Or their God is their wife. Or their God is their children. They see the family as their God. They worship their family. No. Families are good. Marriage is good. Children are wonderful. But let me tell you, that's not what makes life have meaning. And then finally he says to us in verse 29, lo, this only have I found, that God hath made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions or many devices. Now, what's the point of that? Solomon's saying, you know why the world is in such a shape that you can't find sometimes very, very many people who are really valuable and precious to you in your life? You search and hunt to find some real true treasure in life and people, and sometimes it's hard to find. He said, let me tell you, it is not God's fault. God has made us upright. What's gone wrong? We've sought out a lot of inventions to do wrong and devices to do wrong, and so that's why we're the way we are. And you may have heard this story. I like to tell it. I read about it years ago about a man who went to work one day and came home, and his son was waiting for him to get home, and the father was tired, and the father came in, and the son said, Daddy, Daddy, let's play. And the father said, well, son, Oh, Dad's tired. Let me take about a half hour break. I take a nap here, and then we'll play together. And he said, oh, come on, Dad, let's play. But his father looked down there in the newspaper, and they'd gone to the moon, and they'd taken a picture of the earth from the moon. So there's this big, beautiful colored earth in the newspaper. And so his father took a pair of scissors and cut that earth up into a bunch of pieces and scrambled it up and said, son, take this. And he put it on the newspaper. Take this in the other room. He said, when you put the world back together, you call me. We'll go play. So the boy said, okay, Dad. So the boy went in the other room, and it was just all these little pieces. Though there's no way you'll figure that out. So he went in the other room, and in a few minutes, he came back and woke his dad and said, Dad, let's play. He said, son, did you put the world back together, Rod? He said, I sure did, Dad. He said, let me go see. We went in there and looked, and sure enough, that boy had put that world back together just the way it come apart. And the father said, son, you must be a genius. How in the world did you do that? He said, Dad, it was really easy. I couldn't figure out all those colors on that side. I flipped all that over, and I noticed on the other side was a picture of a man. He said, when I put the man together right, the world fell right into place. Can you see what Solomon's trying to tell us? One old boy said, if I could kick the old boy in the backside as hard as I can, it causes me all the trouble in my life, I wouldn't be able to sit down for a week. I am my biggest problem. And when I realize that, and go to work on me, it will help my family, it will help my wife, it will help my brethren, it will help my neighbors, it will help my country, and most of all, it will glorify my God. But you've got to put the man together right. If here tonight, my friend, need to obey the gospel, can't you see the need to come? Confess your allegiance to Jesus tonight. Have the desire to repent. Change your will about everything you're thinking, and make up your mind you're going to believe God's word. And be baptized so your sins can be washed away. Everything you've done will be removed from your slate and cast into the sea. Cast as far as the east is from the west, away from you. And you can rise up and be a child of God and begin to serve. If you're not need to respond anyway, why don't you come and sing a song with me?